You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Eric Herm, a fourth-generation farmer, left his home in West Texas to pursue a career in broadcast journalism. But 9 years later, he returned with concerns for the future of agriculture. In his book, Son of a Farmer, Child of the Earth, A Path to Agriculture's Higher Consciousness, Mr. Herm talks about the issues facing today's farmers, from GMOs to wars over water rights. His book is published by Dream River Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Eric Herm to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Had you missed farming after all those years away from it?
You know, it wasn't so much a missing. I guess it was inside of me. You know, they always say it's in your blood. And after it being in my family for so long, I came back to visit my parents 1 week and was doing some work around them and just kind of walked out into the field and sat there by myself. And I really felt it calling after me, you know, just in that field by myself. And I was surprised by that. And that was really what got me to come back home.
Well, the history of industrialized countries seems to be, and we're seeing it in China today, that people leave the farms and go to the big cities. At least after a few generations, the kids feel enough of this. This is too hard to do, and I'd rather have a more sophisticated life. It is a tough life, isn't it?
It is. You know, when you're dependent on so many different elements to make your living, it's not like you know what your income is going to be when you start the year. With most jobs, you get out there and, you know, it's either one rain or it's either too much or one rain you didn't get that makes or breaks you in a year. And a lot of heartache, that goes on in one crop season, let alone a lifetime of it.
Is that why so many people have left the farms? Is it why we have continually had larger and larger farms as a result?
Yes, there's several different reasons. I think that there was disenchantment with it, with kids growing up in it. You had different events throughout the 20th century, like the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, big droughts, like again in the 1950s in the South, that really discouraged, broke a lot of guys, a lot of farmers. You also had just economics overall, where they weren't able to make it work year after year, and the city was more appealing. It was an easier way to have an expected income, you know, for your family.
Did you notice any big changes from the time when you were a boy, when you returned?
Absolutely. Soil erosion was the main one. West Texas is very, very sandy area. We get a lot of high winds. And barbed wire fences that I crossed as a kid, you know, to walk out across, they were now covered. And fences that were already covered when I was a kid were literally mounds about 30 feet across, where you just walked over and the mounds would be as high as 10 to 12 feet.
So the barbed wire doesn't work under those circumstances.
It just kind of acts as a catching net, you know. It'll just build up over time.
And what crops were grown there in the good old days?
West Texas has always been a cotton country. It's a really dry climate. We get about 17 inches of rain each year. So it's borderline desert climate, and cotton is really one of the only things that'll survive year in and year out. And,
although cotton is hard on the soil, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Any crop that you're growing year after year, you know, I call it the one-trick pony syndrome, that we just go to that one crop that works best for us, and there's no crop rotation, which also leads to soil erosion.
So did you return to grow cotton?
I've grown a little bit of everything since I've been back. I was the first one in my county to have a registered sunflowers there. That was in 2006. Grown wheat, maize, black-eyed peas, and oats.
Well, isn't it good for the soil to grow different crops?
Absolutely. It's a diverse diversity that you're putting into the soil, which brings back different minerals like legume, like a black-eyed pea that grows well in our region, puts organic nitrogen in the soil, which helps the plants grow tall. You can rotate in oats, which is good for phosphorus, which will help it put on more fruit. Just a number of things. You're just adding more life to your soil.
You say that the 3,000-acre family farm will soon be a thing of the past. But I was just speaking to somebody who's very happy with a 500-acre farm, and I've been hearing about a resurgence of small farms, maybe not in Texas, but in areas around big cities like New York.
Well, I mean the size, not necessarily just a farm will be a thing of the past, but I think the size that we've gotten into with commercial agriculture will get much smaller. And 500 acres, I think, is very doable. But right now, as you know, we've gotten so used to cheap fossil fuels or energy, and also subsidies. That's really the only reason that farmers are farming so many acres as we are right now, is because of subsidies.
Is the problem with these agribusinesses a matter of size, or are the methods and materials being used to grow crops?
All the above. I mean, we've been sold like this bag of goods as far as a recipe on how we're supposed to treat our crops or treat our soil, and it's encouraging an environment that creates more weeds, that creates more pests or insects to destroy our crops. I think we've had a lot of brain staining in corporate agriculture, and it's basically so these corporations can sell us a whole lot more product, and it's not really about taking care of our soil or taking care of our plants to bring more life, more energy. It's just about the dollar, you know, or how much income that we can make in 1 year or that company can make off of us.
How big is your farm?
We farm over 6,000 acres.
So it's a big farm.
Yes.
And you're a commercial farmer, aren't
yes.
you? That means you're not an organic farmer.
No, we do organics around our house, and I have two different fields that are in the transition. It takes 3 years for that transition to complete. But we've eliminated commercial fertilizers. We've eliminated pesticides. I've done a lot of crop rotation the last few years and starting to see a significant difference in our soil, the strength of our fields.
Are we seeing that with other commercial farmers? Because in the past, if I had a bunch of different farmers here, small farmers and commercial farmers, the small farmers would say, you are the problem.
Yeah. Oh, I believe that's true.
Including yourself.
I'm a little bit, I still fight that, you know, as far as being part of the problem. Like, I farm so many acres, I don't feel like I'm doing a good enough job, you know, that I should or could be or will be doing in the future because we're spread so thin. So I also farm with my father, so it's two different schools of thought. And so it's a little bit of trying to meet some middle ground with him as well. But I pay so much more attention to our family land, and that's what I'm trying to build up. But we've also rotated in those other crops. And, you know, I feel like I'm doing as much as I can, but it will definitely be improved in the future.
Well, your father is a farmer from a previous generation.
Yes.
What would he be doing if you weren't there?
Oh, that's a good question.
You say you bring in all these other things, but
yeah.
would your father still be pretty much a one-crop farm?
Yes, I think so.
Which crop?
Cotton. You know, that's the meat and potatoes. He's seen it. He's starting to see it. You know, at first it was a real struggle and to talk him into some things. And he remembers growing up where herbicides and pesticides came into play, or particularly herbicides in the 1950s, because he's like, I remember farming organically. You know, we lost our crops to weeds, you know, and it was like a miracle for them whenever these herbicides came on the market. But what we've seen over time, or what we are seeing, that those herbicides aren't having the same effect as they did back in 1950.
It's like antibiotics. After a while, the germs develop some kind of immunity to the drugs, and then you have to find a way of killing the next group.
Exactly, yeah. They'll just come up with a new chemical or rearrange it because weeds, just like insects, they'll grow resistant to these different poisons.
My guest is Eric Herm, H-E-R-M. He's written a book called Son of a Farmer, Child of the Earth. It is published by Dream River Press. You cite the increased use of genetically modified organisms as one of the key issues of agriculture. Why have we seen such a dramatic increase in the use of the GMOs?
Because it's an easier way to farm.
Are they that bad?
I believe so. I mean, to me, eating genetically modified food or growing genetically modified crops is like making love to a toxic blow-up doll, you know, every night. We don't think about it. We're not conscious of it, but that's the way I see it. But the information's not out there, and people don't want to think about it. But it's been in the food system for 20 years now.
Well, according to an article in the New York Times, more than 80% of the corn, soybeans, and cotton grown in the United States is genetically engineered. Would it be possible at this point to reverse that?
Absolutely. I mean, it boils down to the farmer. You know, what are we willing to do? What are we willing to sacrifice? And like I said, most farmers look at everything on a one-year economic plan. But if you're able to look at it over a 5 to 10 year period, you're losing money by putting all your marbles into that genetically modified basket. Because cotton seed for a 50-pound bag, you're talking over $300 in genetically modified. Whereas conventional, which is all we grow, we don't do any of the genetically modified. We catch our own seed, and we're spending like $25 for a 50-pound bag when all things are considered.
Well, the farmers are willing to do the GMOs because they lose less of their crop. So does it wind up being more profitable in the end?
There's no way they can convince me. Some will try to tell you that, but over a 10-year period, there's no way, because you're spending all that money on herbicides, $80 an acre on the average in our, with just the seed and herbicides. You know, it's less wear and tear on their equipment. That's the way they're going to look at it. Less fuel, less labor involved. They go out there, they plant, and then they spray four times a year, and then they harvest. So it's easier.
You're right about some of the warning labels found on the bags of genetically modified cotton seeds that you've seen. What do the labels say?
You know, toxic, do not swallow if you handle by hand. You know, make sure you wear gloves or wash immediately after. It's pretty much the same things that are on the chemical boxes.
So here you are. You have resisted using GMOs, but your neighbors are using them.
Mm-hmm.
So don't you wind up with some GMO cotton anyway?
You'll see it in some, like on the edges. Like we've had instances where herbicide drift from our neighbors has occurred on our fields. And you'll see one plant here and there that didn't get injured or it's still growing. So it happens in the ginning process. It happens in the delinting process where a seed here and there may get mixed in, but it's not the overall crop.
But don't they also cross-pollinate?
Yes, and the genetically modified, its genetic makeup takes over, and so it will register like a genetically modified plant. And so a company like Monsanto have gone into farmers' fields and filed lawsuits against them for catching their own seed when, in fact, they were not catching Monsanto seed. They were catching their own.
So what happens there? Have the courts been more friendly to Monsanto or to the farmers who say, I had nothing to do with this, this was just the wind that created this situation?
Well, Monsanto's got a lot of pull in D.C. They've got a lot of money. They can tie farmers up in courts for years, which they have. Percy Schmeiser was one of the most famous cases, a farmer up in Canada who did win his lawsuit finally against Monsanto. But it's a matter of fact of whether the farmer is willing to stand up against these people.
Well, you say you capture your own seed, but what happens to the seed companies that are competing with Monsanto? Are they having trouble surviving?
Yeah, basically, if you have four or five corporations that rule most of the seed, Monsanto, DuPont, Dow Chemical, Bayer Crop Science, Syngenta, but there still are some independents out there in individual regions. And in ours, we've seen a couple of companies that have really stepped up and tried to put more seed varieties out there and really focus on indigenous seeds.
Do you see this as an environmental problem? You've likened the situation to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. I guess now we could say the BP oil spill.
Mm-hmm. I do, because it affects everything from bees and other insects that pollinate our crops to other animals that are out in the field that may eat or graze upon the crops.
What happens to them? Do the bees actually produce a different kind of honey if they're going to genetically modified plants?
I don't know about a different type of honey, but it alters their DNA or what's inside of them. And, you know, we've seen a large decline. You've heard a lot about colony collapse disorder the last 2 to 4 years. And I can't see how that would not be a part of contributing to that.
You write that our government is as much to blame as Monsanto and DuPont and some of those other big companies. How has the government played a part in the success of this genetically modified approach?
By not regulating it. You know, it came out in the early 1990s. There were few, if any, no experiments done before these crops came out on the market or the foods themselves. It was just like, oh, this is good as natural food, so what's the big deal?
And we've been reassured that it's perfectly healthy. They also want. Yeah. They also assure us that irradiating food is perfectly healthy.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You don't believe in that either?
No. No, not at all.
Are you sure you're a farmer in Texas?
Pretty sure. Yeah.
What happens when you talk to your neighbors about this?
They kind of want to just turn away from it. You know, it's out of sight, out of mind. If they know about it or think about it, then it may really cause them to question what they are doing or how they're making a living. And I can see that, you know.
Do they argue with you?
No.
Do they think you're an idiot for doing it the other way because it's so much more work?
They might. I don't know. No one's called me that, but I don't know what they say when I'm not in the room, you know.
Well, what happens when a farmer chooses not to use the genetically modified seeds? Is pressure applied by the companies?
No. I mean, not in my area. We haven't been subjected to anything like that. But it's just harder on, you know, like I said, it's a more difficult way to farm. There's more labor. There's more work involved. We're out there in the fields working it, hoeing weeds by hand and things like that. That's just, you know, really primitive to most farmers now.
Well, in spite of your criticism of the big companies and the government, you still place most of the responsibility on the farmer.
Yes.
Why farmers are just struggling to survive?
Because it's our choice. We empower these companies. We're the ones using the products. We're the ones out in the fields. It's our land. We have that choice. If we refuse to buy these type of seeds, if 85% of farmers refuse to buy this seed or refuse to buy those type of herbicides to use regularly, the impact, the power that would have across the nation, across the world. So it ends and begins with us, in my opinion.
Well, if you have a huge farm, larger than yours, is it even possible to produce crops profitably without relying on these seeds?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You write that by 2012, wheat, rice, corn, and soy crops will most likely be completely genetically modified.
Yeah, so if we continue on our
same. Holding back the dawn here?
You know, it boils down to individuals' choices and how we act or react from here to then or over the next 5 to 10 years, I wish I could say. But we've got to start educating ourselves and promoting this awareness to facilitate that type of change.
Another big issue is the water supply. How bad is the situation?
Well, we've seen it already in Southern California, you know, with the Central Valley and the feds turned off their water here this last year and a half ago. The Southwest is a dry climate. You know, we've been so dependent on irrigation. We don't irrigate on our family farm where there's no irrigation. We're on the Oglala Aquifer, but we're kind of on the southern end of it where it comes into streams. But just north of us, there's a lot of pivot irrigation, you know, and the driest climate you can possibly imagine in West Texas. You know, I come across an interesting quote by a guy who was in the Army that had scouted out West Texas in the early, mid-1800s, and he said, I basically deem this completely uninhabitable for not only living but agriculture. But here we are, there's more cotton, there's more peanuts and all types of food produced in that area because of irrigation. We've had a huge draw, a huge impact on those aquifers. And at our current rate, we just act like it's there forever, it's going to last forever, and it's not.
Well, I once read that New Mexico sits over one of the largest inland seas, a huge aquifer, but that it has been relatively depleted.
Yes.
Again, because farmers have been sucking up all the water, and is there no way that it gets replenished?
Well, it does, but not at the rate in which we're extracting from it. You know, some of the numbers I've read on the Oglala is that we're extracting 160 times faster than it can replenish itself.
How much of our nation's fresh water supply is consumed by agriculture?
Oh, depending on what you read, it's around 80%, maybe. Up to 85% in some areas.
Well, how do we get around this? Do we just simply stop growing things that require a lot of irrigation in places with little rainfall?
Yeah, that's part of it. I think it's a combination of several things. By making our soil healthier and stronger by rotating in other crops. They're not more susceptible to drought. You know, they'll survive these dry periods longer when they won't need as much water. But, you know, as long as it's okay for these guys to keep pumping and pumping and pumping water with, they can make sense out of their electricity bill, they're going to keep doing it because it's just about generating more product per acre.
You also say that corporations like Nestle, Coca-Cola, and Pepsi have contributed to the problem.
In what way? Well, it's bottled water. You know, it's a $400 billion industry. They're going into areas like up in Michigan where they're just basically sticking their pipe into a natural stream or river and extracting from it. They've been kicked out of certain states, and they'll just move on to the next one. And people are battling it in their communities, you know. And it's, you know, David and Goliath type situation.
My previous guest talked about having farm animals that provided natural fertilizers, but most farmers are not relying on that. They're relying on commercial fertilizers.
Yes.
What do commercial fertilizers have?
Well, it's NPK, or nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, are the three elements that are sold in commercial agriculture. And that was developed by Justus von Liebig in Germany in the 1860s because he burned a plant and he extracted from those ashes those three elements. And so his theory was those were the three elements that the plant needed to survive. Well, 10 years later, he discovered he was wrong, and he published that. But commercial agriculture just took his first theory and ran with it. You know, and these are derived through natural gas. It's elemental, and it's not organic as far as the plant recognizes it, but it's completely foreign to that plant. So it's kind of like using a steroid, you know, like a professional athlete using a steroid. You'll get bigger noticeably, and your color will be green, but it's artificial. It's not natural, and it'll help, you know, that year, but you got to keep injecting it over and over and over.
Does it affect the taste and the nutritional value of the
food? Oh, my goodness,
yeah.
If you have a tomato, just say like Miracle-Gro, for instance, if someone uses a lot of Miracle-Gro in their tomatoes as opposed to someone who actually takes like cow manure and composts their tomatoes and uses all organics, there's no comparison.
I've read that the introduction and mass use of tractors in the 1930s led to the creation of the Dust Bowl. Are we creating an even bigger Dust Bowl now?
I think so. Because, again, with that one-trick pony syndrome where we're just growing that same crop over and over and over. I mean, if you could come to West Texas and see it in February, March, after all the crops are harvested and the winds start blowing 20 to 40 to 50 miles an hour, you know, it's a Dust Bowl, you know, 4 out of 7 days some years.
You have proposed legalizing hemp as a possible remedy to many of our present energy, agricultural, and economic problems. Why is hemp not legal? Because it's connected to marijuana?
Absolutely. I mean, I still can't get my head wrapped around that law or how it ever came into plant. You have a plant that's been used for thousands of years. It's so useful for making clothing, for rope, for, you know, they used it as cells in the Navy. It was temporarily legalized again during World War II to help the Navy out. But then, I don't know, because it looks like marijuana or whatever, but I think it was profitable for some corporations such as DuPont, you know, who came up with inventions in plastics and nylon the year after that marijuana and hemp taxation was passed in 1937. It really benefited them. But how it's continued to be, I have no idea.
Is hemp grow well in your area?
It would grow anywhere. I mean, it did. I don't know. It wouldn't grow as well in our area as it does in the Midwest or in places like Kentucky, Ohio. But, I mean, it grew wild for years. They still have it in bar dishes in a lot of states. You know, it'll grow, and it's extremely useful. It could be grown as tall as trees, and we could harvest it and use it to build houses instead of chopping down forest.
Aren't you fighting a losing battle? This past summer, the EU lifted a ban on the use of GMOs, even though there was a lot of resistance in Europe to them. We're seeing them being used more and more in other parts of the world, especially where there's a great need to produce more agriculture. I suspect we're just going to be living in a GMO world sometime in the near future.
I can't accept that. I mean, if it's a losing battle, I don't know it. You know, it's just, again, what are you worth? What's worth standing up for you? What's worth fighting for? You've seen areas like in California, certain counties in Connecticut that will put a ban on GM used crops. And I know that there are many other groups out there that are anti-GMOs that are starting to speak up and spread some awareness and educate farmers and other people on it. So I really don't think it's a losing battle at all. I think we're just beginning to fight.
Eric Herm's book is Son of a Farmer, Child of the Earth, A Path to Agriculture's Higher Consciousness. It is published by Dream River Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.